This is an encore presentation of Unreserved. Enjoy.
Hello, my name is Darlene. I am now 28 years old. I have spent 18 years of my life in foster care.
Darlene Keeper was only 6 months old when she was apprehended by Child and Family Services the first time. She would spend years shuttled from foster home to foster home until finally being shuffled out at 18 years old. Darlene's story is not unique. Her experience mirrors that of tens of thousands of Indigenous kids in care.
To be honest, I think that my brain is just kind of protecting me from all of the trauma that I experienced.
A trauma that is real and recognized. In 2016, the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal ruled that the federal government discriminated against First Nations children by underfunding the on-reserve child welfare system, a system that pays little attention to the consequences of removing children from their homes. The ruling comes with a promise to fix a broken child welfare system. Danse Anin Buju. Hello and welcome. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. The decision by the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal forced Canada to strike a $40 billion child welfare agreement with First Nation leaders. It will set aside $20 billion to compensate young Indigenous people who've been harmed by Canada's child welfare system. Another $20 billion will go toward long-term reform of the child welfare system on reserve. But what could reform look like? And where do we even start? Today on Radio Indigenous, from heart work to home fires, meet Indigenous people changing the system. To know where we're going, we need to know where we've been, even if that journey is dark. Darlene Keeper's earliest memory of being in foster care starts at 9 years old. And a note to listeners, this show includes references to child abuse, suicide, and addiction. Please take care of each other.
So on my birthday, my mom tried to commit suicide, and because me and my siblings were in the house that she was trying to light on fire, the courts and the social workers presumed that she was trying to kill us as well. And so I had to go to court and defend my mother, because I remember very specifically her telling me to get my siblings out of the house and go to CFS. And then from there, I was temporarily placed in the group home, which is across the lake, still in the community. And then this part I don't remember, but I remember reading it in my file, is that I was threatening to kill myself. So they put me into a mental health institution in Winnipeg, but it wasn't for children. I don't know, maybe because they didn't have one back then, but I was with adults. And so that was pretty traumatic as well, because there were some people, like one woman there, she had severe cuts on every inch of her body. Another one saw like flames and spiders in the bedroom and would kind of like go into anxiety. But I was there because I wrote a little note saying, I want to die. But I guess maybe, I mean, at 9 years old, I probably got that from my mother and thought maybe, I don't know, I could go where she is. If she did the same, maybe I could go see her. And then from there, as my former foster parents would say, I got chosen out of a special book to come and live with this family. So that's, I guess, where a lot of my trauma comes from, because they were pretty abusive for 8 years, and I ran away like 3 times. And each time I tried to say something, no one ever believed me. And I ran away for the last time, I think it was the fourth time. And I said, like, I'm never going back, and I don't care what you do if you make me go back. Like, I'm not, there's just not an option this time. And then so I guess they finally listened to me and I didn't go back there. And then so I lived in one final home until I was 18. And like the family was good. And then, my social worker changed and he got me funding for club volleyball because I was an avid sport player. And then I got a volleyball scholarship. And then, at 18, I was just kind of left on my own. And I guess I ruined my volleyball career because I was too depressed and drinking my life away. When you're 18, I guess you're an adult, right? According to the system, but that's what I want to change. As a child, I think all I needed was just a little more recognition or appreciation for my efforts. Because I think that as a child, I could have been more exceptional, but no one gave me the acknowledgement. So I want to see more success in education for Indigenous youth, because that's what saved me. And that's also what's kept me out from poverty. Being Indigenous and being a former youth in care, there are bursaries and funding that I can apply for to help me achieve my goals. And I feel that if you want to get out of that cycle of generational trauma, you need to go and get educated. And so I applied into the Faculty of Social Work. My focus is on policy analysis and research for social initiatives within Indigenous communities, trying to see what works and what clearly doesn't work, which is right now. and then try to, you know, put in my recommendations for change.
That's Darlene Keeper. She spent 18 years in Manitoba foster care. She is now a student in the Faculty of Social Work. Darlene knows firsthand the flaws in the system. And so does Mary Burton. She's a 60 Scoop survivor and the legal guardian of grandchildren who've been in foster care themselves. Today, Mary is the executive director of Fearless R2W, an organization that helps parents in Winnipeg's North End reunify with their children in care. And as it turns out, Mary's also my former neighbor. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rosanna.
So good to see you again.
Yes, it is. It's been a while.
Yes, and I hear you being a superhero out in the neighborhood. Let's get into that conversation.
I wouldn't say I was a superhero, but yeah, I do a lot of loving heart work that I would not change for anything.
Now, the R2W of Fearless R2W comes from the postal code of Winnipeg's North End. How would you describe this neighborhood for those who've not been here?
A thriving, beautiful mixed match of people who all come together and look out for one another, love each other. They love their neighborhood. They love the children. They take care of each other. Truly the original village. And it should be hailed as the village more than the North End.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, it's a lovely neighborhood to be a part of, but it certainly has its challenges. What kinds of challenges does this neighborhood face?
This neighborhood faces a lot of poverty, a lot of CFS involvement, a lot of stigma because of the media. We get a lot of bad media in the North End.
Why do you think that is?
I honestly couldn't tell you. Yeah. I don't know. The North End is predominantly people of color. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the stigma that comes with being a person of color, let's say Indigenous, they're alcoholics, they're drug addicts, they're violent, they're gang members. And in reality, they're not. They're single parents trying to make ends meet. They're youth who have lost their way and need a couple of good, really good adults in their lives to bring them back. You know, it's not all bad, but everybody looks at it like it is.
And certainly you're one of the stories in the North End, one of the people, the doers, the helpers that are making changes in our neighborhood. And thus you helped with creating Fearless R2W. How did it come to be?
Well, Fearless R2W was born out of the Bell Tower movement back in 2014. Michael was still doing the Friday evening Bell Towers, and they were talking about all the violence that was happening in the community. And a few grandmothers said to him, you know, you're all about stopping the violence, but you're not trying to stop the violence that CFS is perpetuating against our families. At that time in the R2W area, 1 in 6 kids were being apprehended daily. It's a little bit better now. It's more like 1 in 10 now, but it was really bad. It's still bad, but it was worse when we first started. So then he called me up. I've known Michael since he was 18 years old, and we work really well together over the years. He calls me up and he goes, I know what to do. I don't know how to start it. So then we sat down, we had lunch. I said, okay, we're done talking. Let's start doing. We had no money. We had no organization to back us up. It was just me and Michael going to organizations saying, hey, can we use your space to hold a meeting? So the very first meeting, it ended up being just me and Michael with a whole table full of food that I cooked to feed the people, and nobody showed up. And it was like that for about 6 months. Nobody showed up. And we expected that. We expected it to take a long time for people to trust us. So after about 6 months, people started to slowly trickle in. And they started coming and they started telling us what they needed. And then I started reading legislation. And I read the CFS Act. And again, I tell you, I know that thing inside and out now. I know it frontwards, backwards, and forwards, and upside down. I use it. I use it to the best of my ability. And I train advocates on how to deal with CFS workers, and I teach them how to use the legislation to the best of their ability.
Mm. Well, you certainly come from with a lot of education and preparation. Let's unpack that a little bit. When you refer to Michael, of course, you mean Michael Champagne Redhead, or is it Redhead Champagne? I just get those mixed up. And he, of course, is a very well-known advocate in the Indigenous community here in Winnipeg. And nationally, he does a lot of work with youth and with our village, as you had referred to. When you were having those meetings with Michael and trying to gain the trust of community, what was it you were trying to achieve with Fearless R2W?
We were trying to help our community not be afraid. That is why we're called Fearless R2W. Mm. And the way I understand things, the way I do things, is knowledge is power. Mm-hmm. The more you know about something, the less you fear it. And that's why I read so much legislation and I try to understand it. It's because I'm a 60 scoop survivor, mm-hmm. right? I was apprehended from my family and taken away and put into non-Indigenous homes. And so I didn't want my children or my grandchildren to ever suffer what I suffered.
Yeah,
I fought long and hard to keep my children out of the system, and it worked. None of my children were in the system. My grandchildren were only in the system for about a month, and then I got them. So I successfully stopped that merry-go-round of historical interactions with CFS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I understand legislation and because I had learned about it and I have that knowledge now, I know that I can fight and I can win.
Well, you certainly are fearless, Mary, I gotta say. Already I'm impressed. But when you say you want to teach your neighborhood and these parents fighting within this system or fighting the system to be fearless, how do you do that? What kinds of practical things are you telling them?
The biggest thing I tell them is to watch their emotions. Mm. And, you know, and that's really hard to say to somebody, and it's really hard for somebody to do. But I know that it works, because in the system, the way it works is if you lash out emotionally and you're angry, I have to say, you have every right to be angry. You have every right to own those feelings. But if you do that in front of the wrong people, they're going to label you as angry, as difficult, and emotionally charged. And those are bad things to be labeled in the CFS system. So what I tell people when they're first, my first meeting with them is, tell me it all, give it all to me, yell at me, swear at me. I got thick skin, I can handle it. Mm. And they do. And then they feel better. And then we can get down to business and we can figure out, okay, what was the reason for the apprehension? When is court? When is your first meeting with the agency? You know, and all of those things all come together once that person is emotionally able to handle it. Mm-hmm. And when we go into meetings with the social workers, I have found more often than not, there are more people on the CFS side of the table than on the parent side of the table. So parents are expected to go into these safety meetings where there's four or five agency workers and them. That's it. So we go with them and we sit on their side of the table. And I think that my resting bitch face scares people. I don't know if I could say that word on this in this interview, but I did. Sorry. But, you know, I am very vocal about the parents' rights because the other people on the other side of the table, they are more concerned with what the children need, what the children want, what the children don't have. And what I have to do is I have to bring a common denominator between both sides of the table and say, okay, how can we meet in the middle? And how can we make it work? And then if the agency comes up with a service contract, I'll read it over. And 9 times out of 10, it says the parent has nothing about what the agency is going to do. So then I'll say to the agency, well, if this is a contract, what are you going to do to the family? You want this parent to go to parenting classes. You give the parent bus tickets to get to those parenting classes. You want this parent to go through anger management. You get a list of anger management courses and you give it to the parent and you give the parent transportation to get to those. And then visits is a big thing too. They don't want to give visits because of COVID these days. So what we did was we got an organization to donate to us some old used computers, laptops, and tablets. And we make sure that the parents have the electronic tools that they need to have virtual visits. It's all about having a hand up and not a hand out. Because if we give them a hand up and we say, hey, you can do this, we believe in you, then that is so much more important to them than actually having a laptop or a tablet to actually do the Zoom visits with their children.
How do you incorporate Indigenous ways of knowing into Fearless R2W's work? Because it sounds very cultural to me.
It is very cultural. You're right. We have a set of values that we read at every meeting, and it helps ground us into who we are. We do smudging and we explain what the smudge is at every meeting. And we do what we call Wakoto. It's a Cree word and it means family. It also means that we are all connected and we take that very seriously.
Why do you think it's important to be rooted in Indigenous ways of knowledge and culture?
Because it was stolen from us. And for many years, it was against the law for us to practice our culture and our teachings so that everybody knows that this is who you are. This is your right. It's not a privilege. It's a right.
Yes. Earlier, Mary, you had talked a little bit about your own experience as a child in the system, as a 60s scoop survivor. Can you share a little bit more about what your experience was like as a survivor?
I was apprehended when I was 10 and I was put into a foster home. I was in many, many, many foster homes over an 8-year period. I aged out of care. In every group home that or foster home that I was put in, I was the one who didn't belong. So I was bullied. I had to put up with threats and I had to put up with getting beat. I had to put up with being told that I was only good for one thing, and that was cleaning or cooking or being a battering ram for somebody. I had to put up with being told by the agency that I'm going to end up growing up being a prostitute and hooked on drugs and alcohol, because all Indian girls are good for is getting high and drunk. That was one of the things I was told. I think they were trying to break my spirit. But what they don't realize is they made me stronger. Because I vowed that day that I would prove them wrong. That my community, my people are better than that.
And how has that experience as a 60 scoop survivor influenced the work you do now?
I think it's the reason I started advocating to begin with, because that was always in the back of my head. It was always there. Every time I tried something new, there was that little voice in my head saying, you're not going to succeed, Mary. You're just an Indian girl. All you're good for is getting drunk and high. That was always there. And I always had to push it down and say to myself, no, Mary, that's not true. That's not true at all. And every time I succeeded, that voice got quieter and quieter and quieter to the point where I don't hear it anymore.
And of course, you also live by example. You and your husband care for your grandchildren who are also previously in the system. How has that experience informed your work?
It is a blast having my grandkids with me. I am the one who should be raising them if their mother can't. They're my family. Their mom couldn't do it for various reasons, but I'm healthy. I am knowledgeable. I am able to raise them until she is ready to, if she's ever ready to. But when that day comes, I will gladly say, here you go, my girl. I took care of them until you were able to. Because that's my role as a grandmother.
So when you look at your grandkids and think about their future, what do you hope that their lives will look like?
I hope that they have the knowledge that they need to succeed. I hope they have the pride that I've been trying to instill in them all of their lives about who they are and what they can do. I hope they're very proud to be Indigenous, and I hope they know that they can do anything that they've set their minds to. Because Grandma did it. If I can do it, they can do it.
Now, the big news, of course, is the federal government will be spending $20 billion to reform Indigenous child welfare. How do you think that money should be spent so that kids like your grandchildren and the kids in our village have that kind of future?
Well, they need to put money into sustainable programming. There is not enough programming on reserve, not enough sustainable programming on reserves for children to be able to get anywhere in life. In Manitoba, we are a province that funds new programming constantly, but we never sustain the successful ones. So they need to have some type of sustainable programming for addictions, for housing, for clean water. Clean water, people. It's not rocket science. These are really important things that need to be put in place for them to be successful. And that we also need to have sustainable funding in off reserve for the families that are dealing, who reunited but left the reserve because there's no clean water. There's no sustainable housing. What are they supposed to do? They left reserve, came to the city. Well, guess what? There's crazy amounts of high rents in the city. So that's what some of the money should go to. This money is going to make a difference if they do it right.
Mary, thank you so much for your time. And even though you don't say you're a superhero, thank you for your superhero work.
Thank you, Rosanna.
Mary Burton is the executive director of Fearless R2W in Winnipeg. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Coming up.
It doesn't necessarily mean bringing all the children back home, but it means that it starts there. It starts with that culture, feeling the land, remembering who you are and where you come from.
Building a home fire in the long shadow of residential school on Cowessess First Nation, Saskatchewan. Taking us there, this is Iskwe, featuring Tanya Tagak with The Unforgotten. We are the world that's forgotten. We stand up tall against the other side. We are the nation of tomorrow. We are the children who are not afraid to die.
Hello, my name is Julie. Unfortunately, I lost my mom back in 2014 to a serious drinking and driving accident, and it left me and my four siblings alone to the world to navigate it, which left me very lost, very confused. I was just a fresh 15-year-old. My little brother was, his birthday had been 5 days prior to her dying. And it was actually one of the most devastating things because we had an 8-month-old and another year and a half year old that I was helping her raise. So it was really difficult. A kind aunt of ours took us in. Well, took three of us, took the girls and my little brother. Unfortunately, he stayed in Winnipeg and he lived with his, on his dad's side with his grandmother there. And he had some challenges there too, where he went in and out of the system and in and out of the justice system because he wasn't coping too well. Our mom was our rock. We didn't have our dads really part of our lives. And when they were, they weren't. Ah, sorry, I'm going to tear up here. People say that people will die within at least a 5-kilometer radius from your house. And it's not a joke. My mom was headed home. The worst part of it was because it was so public and because it became a court case, I got severe bullying through school. I got severely bullied through other people. Her friends were very upset that we didn't do the things that they wanted. And no one helped me. It actually took me quite a few years to learn that some adults actually do not know how to grieve or cope with the death of a person. And that's not what I do, is I try to help people cope with death and loss and healing and their healing journeys, because the longest path we ever take is that from your head to your heart. So it's a beautiful teaching that we're taught through Indigenous. Yeah, so I actually got taken out of my mom's home before she died, which is ironic. I was more of my mom's best friend than I was her daughter. And it was very difficult because I raised my mom before she raised me. So at 7 years old, I was already raising a 26-year-old and a 6-year-old, because my little brother is 1 year younger than me. Because I left my mom's at 13 years old, 2013, so I had just turned 14, actually. And the school usually was an escape for me just to get away from the stress. It was like raising my sisters. And then I went to move in with my aunt, and it was good. I've never lived in a house with no poverty. I've never lived in a house where two people are married and they love me. That I've never been to a properly functioning school and had a proper sleep schedule. Unfortunately, with my aunt, I don't know what happened between us, but within that year we started to fight really negatively, and it was getting to, okay, I think you're going back home to your mom. And then that summer I was coming home and my mom died. So from there she took in me and my two little sisters, and by grade 11 I had been kicked out, the same thing my mom had did to me. I do not see my little sisters anymore, actually. So given through everything and all the rough, harsh experiences that like I go through and all us kids go through, it's a motivation for us too, because we want to invoke a change. If it doesn't change now, it's going to change next generation. And that's the most that we can do. So for me, I've taken all that pain and trauma and I've flipped it around into a positive thing. So always look at your privileges too, right? So the fact that I've gone through this, I can make a change in the world and make sure that others don't go through it at some point. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to school. I'm just going to increase all my knowledge, increase my power, increase my open-mindedness, learn as much as I can, and implement the biggest change I can. And it's going to start small, and it's going to cause ripple effects. And little by little that I do, those ripple effects will get bigger, and it will turn into like how a tsunami is. And it'll be a big tsunami of like healing and happiness, or just wherever the wind takes us, I guess. Creator has a path for us. That's all we can follow. He doesn't tell us distinctly. He just says, walk your path and I'll let you know.
Julie is one of the youth who shared her experiences with us about the child welfare system and her hopes in bringing lasting change. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Bringing our children home, all of them. That's the goal of Cowessess First Nation. If the name sounds familiar, it's because the Saskatchewan First Nation made headlines last year after 751 unmarked graves were found at the Merivale Indian Residential School on its territory. While the work to identify the remains continues, Cowessess is working to end that cycle of harm, and it's all emerging from the reserve's Chief Red Bear Lodge.
Basically, it's the container of the home fire.
Eva Coles is the CEO of Chief Red Bear Lodge, the creation that came out of Bill C-92, the law that now recognizes First Nation authority for child and family services. And Cowessess First Nation is in the midst of creating its own system of care, one that helps the entire family, not just the child. Working alongside Eva is Nicole Cook, a member of Cowessess First Nation and the associate CEO. It took a long time for Nicole to return to her home community, and it was at the insistent invitation of Cowessess Chief Cadmus DeLorme.
Called me regarding this project to jump on to for the Meopa Matiswin Act. He wanted my support because I have lots of child care background and nursing background behind me. And so I jumped on as a volunteer and I supported wherever I could. And eventually he just said, I want you to come home. He welcomed me with open arms. And so the home fire, when I was able to walk the land that my cookum lived on, it like had this huge impact on me. And I think that that's what we need to build it out of. That's what Eva's talking about when she talks about home fire. It doesn't necessarily mean bringing all the children back home, but it means that it starts there. It starts with that culture, feeling the land, remembering who you are and where you come from.
It's a beautiful place to start, certainly. And I definitely want to get more details on what that home fire might build in the future. But let's back up a little bit to your own stories and how you came to be in this home fire. Eva, you spent 35 years working in Indigenous communities. What did you see in your work that indicated that this system was not working for Indigenous children in foster care?
Just on so many levels. Meeting youth that were wanting to connect to home but would arrive in tears because no one knew them, to attending situations with child welfare workers where it was so abrupt and brutal. And then the rules that were in place of families not able, no matter what hoops they were jumping through, that they weren't having their children returned to them. And I'm a non-Indigenous person and would arrive at hospitals or different group situations and be treated completely different than my clients. And so it was so obvious in every which way, shape or form. And I just started to be that square peg in a round hole, always banging down the door. In 2014, I wrote a mission statement about what I would be doing as a Canadian. And that was to change things, no matter what it took, I would change things for children, Indigenous children in this country, in child welfare.
Wow. So you pretty much manifested your own destiny there, Eva.
Yeah.
What you're doing now, is it reflective of what you wrote on that piece of paper those many years ago?
This is maybe far more than I thought I could do. The ideas and the wisdom that we have in our group, I know is going to make an amazing difference. I know in our first year, we're not even hitting our first year anniversary yet. There are no children in care on the Cowessess Reserve at this moment in time. It's zero.
Wow. That is an amazing accomplishment when you consider some of the numbers across Canada of Indigenous people in care. Nicole, you worked off reserve before coming to work on Cowessess with Eva. Tell me about your experience.
I was actually born and raised in the Prince Albert area. My family was pretty poor. I also was raised in a very abusive home and went through a lot of hardships as a child, you know, experienced a lot of racism, a lot of that kind of stuff as I was growing up. And because of the abuse that I faced as a kid, I really steered away from my childhood of learning about my culture. Like, it's almost like a survival mode, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. Started working when I was 14 and I got my own vehicle and I was just like set. I was like, hey, I'm out of this situation, you know? And I ended up going back to school and I took my nursing program at DeMont Technical Institute in Prince Albert. And I met the, you know, my husband, and I was set. We got pregnant. I was a nurse. I was making $21 an hour, and I was so excited. Then I had my first boy, and he was born with complex medical needs. Mm-hmm. And he was tube fed till he was 3 and a half. He's had 5 surgeries. We were in and out of hospital for a while. Me and Steven, we stayed by his side, and eventually, because he wasn't working, I wasn't working, we had to sell everything that we got in Prince Albert, and then we moved into Regina in Steven's parents' basement. And I was like, hey, we got to get back on our feet. So I started working at the Pasqua Hospital, and I heard about a lady who had a little daycare out of her 1,000-square-foot home that took children with complex needs because she was an ICU nurse. So I went into her 1,000-square-foot home in 2007 with Ethan, and right from that moment, she was like, you were meant to be here. She's like, you need to help me. You need to help me grow this organization. And so I did, and I helped her grow Hope's Home. What it's called today is Hope's Home. I worked there for 14 years, and I helped establish a nonprofit organization that takes care of children with complex medical needs. It went from the 4 kids in a 1,000-square-foot home up to taking care of over 550 children throughout the province of Saskatchewan and over a $14 million operational budget throughout Saskatchewan. So that was my experience.
Insert applause here. That's amazing.
Learning as I went, basically, from startup, from nothing. So, but I, something was missing. And I had, you know, a great career, life, all of it. And eventually spirit started hitting me. Spirit, owls were flying directly at my face, looking me directly in the eye and flying over. And I knew something had to change. And that's when I started looking more at like who I am as an Indigenous woman. And that's where I found true healing for just accepting who I am. And that's when Chief came along, and just, it led me to Cowessess. And I know this is my journey. This is my path, because all of the hardships that I experienced as a child, not finding home and then helping with the development of Hope's Home, led me directly to home, which is Cowessess.
What an incredible journey you have both been on, and what an incredible wealth of experience you bring to this incredible task that you have in front of you, creating a completely new way to take care of our children. Let's talk about that a little bit. What is it you're trying to do differently with this, Eva?
Basically trying to dismantle everything that's come before us, which is the huge work of it all. Looking at the systems that are in place now, and actually a question that we have in our daily work is, well, if we don't like that, what would be the opposite of that? We don't think we want to do foster care. So what is the opposite of that? The overall mission is to ensure that no more children are going into care. And that's a big task.
Now, how usually it works is you take the child out of the home, and all of the resources go with that child to whatever home they're being placed in. Are you doing something differently, making sure there's supports within the home that they live in, or what are you doing that's different?
So far, what we've been able to do is any time that there's a child welfare involvement on Cowessess, is that we've been able to work with the family and keep everyone together and at home and add supports. We will offer therapy and all of those kind of things, but you can have a community cook-em come to visit you as well and sit with you, just to sit with you for no particular reason. And so those cook-ems also attend family meetings with us and ensure that families feel secure. And sometimes it's quite interesting because they actually give the hardest and most challenging advice to families. So, they're a little stricter.
As cook-ems will do.
They will. They will absolutely put people in their place if they feel they need something. And then we also have just acquired our third unit where parents have had their children in care. And we're able to reunite the whole family together into our own program. And so the whole family comes in together, and it's supportive care for up to, right now it's up to a year that you can basically come and live with us. And we supply the counseling and the life skills and the supports, the therapies for the children and assessments, and get everyone back into school, including parents. And then we've just acquired a transition home where that same family, we're just graduating a family right now. They're moving into the transition home for a few months, and then they're waiting for the next home that might be available on the reserve to move into.
Wow.
And so they'll become a full-fledged community member. So in that program, in the last year, we've kept 11 children out of care. And then the number of homes that we've gone to, we've either had other family members help out, or we had one family where our staff came in for 24-hour care in the home and supported everyone in the home until we could sit down with the entire family and make a plan from there. We assisted the family. We interviewed everybody as they felt comfortable. We let people sleep, because often when they're in crisis, they just need to sleep and get food and be nourished and supported before they can really talk about what's going on. So we have several different ways that we're working at things depending on what families need. And so we're taking each family individually and letting them know that we see all of them, not just the crisis. The family that I talked about, they needed some repairs in their house. So we made sure that those repairs got done so that the bathtub was working so grandma could bath the kids. You'll often hear in our business the social determinants of health, but we're truly bringing that to life. We have physicians and nurses on staff. We have early childhood people on staff already. And we're just building a team that reflects all of the different aspects that a family could need.
That is amazing. So you're taking care of not just the child. It's not a child welfare system anymore. It's a family care system, really,
is
what I'm hearing. Now, anything you try to build will have its challenges and maybe some roadblocks. What kinds of hurdles or roadblocks have you encountered in trying to make this?
Things that people wouldn't even think of. It's not regulated to have workers' compensation on the reserve, but it is regulated into the province of Saskatchewan. Do I need to get WCB for them? Occupational health and safety. Like, we shouldn't have had to have a business number, but we ended up having to have a business number because the bank wouldn't give us, a bank account without one, right? So there's just all of these things that we're just navigating through to figure out. Yeah.
So no one knows how to handle it. And so we spend a lot of our time actually breaking down the barriers, hopefully for other First Nations coming behind us. We would love more than anything to be always working on the visioning and creating the services, but we are actually having to truly build the organization.
What about your relationship with the federal government? How is that? How is that going?
Actually, I want to say, because I've been around for so long and I've been at the tables when all there's been screaming and fighting and pounding tables and people walking out of meetings. Is this particular transfer of power, if you want to call it that, or this transfer of law, has been one of the most respectful processes I've ever witnessed. And I think we were always ready for the shoe to drop that, this wasn't going to happen, but it did. And I think in a large part, it had to do with the approach that Chief DeLorme has taken, of understanding that this was never a negotiation. This is the inherent right of Cowessess to do this. And always reminding people at the beginning of every single meeting, as we're not negotiating, that's finished. We're now just transferring everything over that it was always ours.
You mentioned some of the, you listed some of the work that you're doing with the program currently. What other plans do you have in the works? If it's a short list.
Oh my gosh. So
I have a
much
plan with Eva. that we're hoping that eventually in the future we, you know, will partner with the Ministry of Education and potentially open a couple childcare facilities, one in Regina and one on Cowessess, with that $10 a day childcare agreement that's coming into play, so that we can actually implement our own programs. That would mean building little sweat lodges, teaching them how to pick sweet grass, and, you know, all in all, monitoring developmental milestones, as well as potentially having a program that will help with the parenting side of things.
Mm-hmm. Now, Cowessess, of course, was in the national spotlight, as I mentioned, last June, when 751 unmarked graves were identified at the former residential school there. How has that attention affected the work that you're doing here?
It was actually very, very heavy. We basically had to switch our focus and help our citizens, help Cowessess go through the process of the news. And it did affect our focus for a little while, for sure.
Yeah. I saw Cowessess actually go very quiet. The citizens needed that time, as Nicole described, to grieve the information and take it in. And at the same time, we were getting a lot of media attention. We were getting people who were doing cross-country walks and pilgrimages to Cowessess, and visitors coming and stopping in. So we started a comfort station. We have a little office that's not too far from the gravesite. And so we just converted it into being open days and nights. People wanted to drop by, you know, Canadians from all over wanted to come and talk. And so we would just put down whatever we were doing and explain whatever questions they had. It was lots to carry. And our doors remained open, and you can still come into our Chief Red Bear Children's Lodge office and get a sandwich. Mm-hmm.
You know, the poignancy of what you're doing on Cowessess, in light of those little babies that didn't get to go home, is not lost on me. What does it mean for both of you to be doing this work and have this opportunity to build something new that will bring these children home and possibly end this cycle, at least for your First Nation?
What does it mean for me to be doing? I'm honored to I can't even talk very well because I'm in tears, but I feel like it's a gift that was handed to me, that I get to stop that line, to make that change, and to be, and I will work day and night in order to make sure that this is successful, that we make a difference, that we change what has happened. And it's an honor for me. It's, you know, I'm very humbled and I'm honored to do this work.
It's a good word. It's honored, because you never know where you're going to end up in life. You're guided to wherever you're supposed to be. And I know that. And so I can only take what's in front of me and hope that I contribute to some small part of this. And I just look one by one, and I have to remind the staff to look one by one, because the enormity of it can cave us so quickly about being responsible for all of those children and all of their families at once. So I'm constantly reminding us it's one by one. Every family that's put in front of you, that's the family we're going to assist right now. And recently we had a child that came to us through one of our programs. He and a couple of his siblings hadn't been speaking. They were just school age. And through a lot of work with us, the first words that one of them spoke was actually Cree in school in front of their Cree teacher. And they recorded it, all of the trauma that little fella had been through. And the first time he chose to speak was to speak his own language. And when we look at examples like that, we know we're going somewhere. We just have to keep adding on that success.
And Nicole, what about for you? What does success look like for you?
I think success for me is, I guess, our citizens taking ownership of it all. like Eva said, she wants to back away. And she does say that to us a lot, that it takes your community to be engaged, to make the difference. So having all of our community engaged in the process and understanding that I don't need to call social services because I've got this, you know, that's what success looks like to me, as well as reinstilling our culture into our people. I think that our people need to be proud of our culture and stand strong with it. And all of our citizens that have been lost along the way need to have that same feeling, that sense of home, that sense of culture.
When they're all sitting around the home fire.
Exactly. Yeah.
Nicole, Eva, thank you so much for your time and your wisdom and your work. You're like superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Eva Coles is the CEO of Chief Red Bear Lodge at Cowessess First Nation. Nicole Cook, a member of the nation, is the associate CEO. That's all our time this week. This episode was produced by Laura Bone-Steubing, Kim Kasher, Aaron Knoll, Kata Dack, and me, Rosanna Deerchild. You can find more on our website at cbc.ca/unreserved. Download the podcast on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your favorite cousin, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Ganaskinamitnawi, Agusay.